This is Pro Bono Radio.
Hi, everyone. Before we start today, we just want to acknowledge that we are meeting today and recording on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory. Okay, so I am Michelle.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm a 1L student at Queen's Law.
Sego, my name is Stacia, and I'm a 2L student at Queen's Law.
So today we're going to be talking about the Indigenous experience at law school. So Rachel and Stacia are both two self-identified Indigenous students here. So first, I just want to ask, what motivated you both to attend law school?
So I have a definite interest in social justice issues, and I actually did a lot of my undergrad in that area. So when I was trying to figure out what to do after my undergrad, my dad was like, well, because he's the Indigenous person in my family, so he was like, you should get into law and, you know, make some changes, like, for, like, Indigenous, like, rights and issues, and, like, you can actually make some meaningful changes if you care this much. And I'm like, okay, like, maybe that's the pathway to go. And then I actually did paralegal first because I didn't know for sure if I wanted to jump right into law school, and then I liked that enough, and so I went to law school after.
And so for me, I think my motivation came from my daughter, who is also in university. So I decided when she got into school, that I would then write the LSAT and apply, because it was one of my lifelong goals. But because I primarily did my undergrad when she was a baby, I took that time to work and to really try to, you know, come to a decision as to whether or not this is something that I thought that would be useful for me, be useful for the community, and really wanting to put that energy and, you know, in a place that, you know, that made sense. So I'm glad I took that time to do that. And I mean, I really am looking in terms of, I think, you know, long-term goals is to be able to contribute meaningfully to Indigenous communities. So whether that's my own community, whether that is the Indigenous community in the province, in the country, or even globally, I think that's something that, you know, that is important, because there's so many overlapping and concurrent issues that need to be addressed.
So before we get into those issues, I wanted to talk a bit about both of your experiences here at the law school and at Queen's Law in particular. So whether or not you think your experience is different in any way from non-Indigenous students generally or in class, do you feel that your experience has been unique in any way?
I think my experience has been quite different, maybe perhaps even from not only the average law student, but also to the average Indigenous law student, self-identified Indigenous law student at Queen's. I think because of my own personal schedule, I don't live in Kingston. I'm not on campus that often. So I don't get all of, like, the day-to-day, you know, I guess, interactions. Or even, you know, like the vibe of the law school, or even like social activity. So I'm not involved, I think, in the same way that perhaps others are. But in terms of the experiences that I have had, I can say that, you know, there have been instances where I've experienced some racism, some stereotyping by professors on specific subjects. And I think also, too, I mean, the fact that Indigenous students are looked to at the school to solving the problems rather than looking to the people who are in those positions of power and authority to be able to take on that leadership to make those things happen. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the issues that I've had is that not only being an Indigenous student here trying, you know, to go to school, to focus, to do all of the other daily things that I need to do in my life, but then to have to come to solve the law school's problem is not my job.
Of course, you're here to learn as well.
Right.
I also agree with that completely. I personally think that sometimes, like, the profs in classrooms, like, and I'm okay with it to a point, but, like, if we're talking about Indigenous issues that speak to, like, a nation that I'm not even familiar with, like, I can only really speak from, like, my Ganyange Haga perspective. Like, I don't really know how to speak to other things, but I find them sometimes, like, looking to me as an authority, and it's like, I don't really know. Like, I can't comment on, like, an issue of a group that I'm not even, like, identified with or know the background history on a case or something. I appreciate that they do kind of look to make sure that it's kind of like, okay, if they're saying stuff, I really like that part. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know how to, like, respond all the time, because I'm like, I don't really know, like, what to say. Like, I can only really speak on my own experiences, and I can't speak on anyone else's, especially if it's another tribe or group that I'm not familiar with. So
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, the law school is in an interesting position just in terms of reconciliation, mm-hmm. and the committee that they have in place in order to address some of these, you know, these calls to action. And I think that those calls, they're serious, and I feel as though the school is taking, you know, those calls serious to a point. You know, there are changes that have been made since I've been here, and of course, it's only been a short time. It's only been 2 years, but I think the school needs to do better. You know, they're the call to action, and, you know, I don't have them in front of me, but it might be call number 94. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's to have Indigenous courses or Indigenous content in all law schools, and at least have that be mandatory. And I think the approach here has been, well, you know what, we will put that into professors' hands to be able to incorporate or weave in points of Indigenous issues and some of their content. But not all professors choose to do that.
Right.
Some will say, well, you know what, it's just so complex, or I only have I have limited material on this, so I'm not going to talk about it. So it's not included. But I mean, I think if the school is really serious about reconciliation, then there needs to be a change in the course requirements for JD, for the JD requirements in order to graduate.
I like that idea for sure.
And I mean, we focus too, like, on the name of the school, right? So, I mean, you were talking or asking about, you know, our experiences, you know, as Indigenous students. And I mean, you know, I'm not sure how necessarily, and again, I can't speak for all Indigenous law students at Queen's, but I know that every time I walk into this building, you know, I look at Sir John A's name. Actually, I don't even call him Sir John A. I just call him John A.
Yeah.
I don't even. I know. And I have to look at that every day, you know, and it's frustrating. And I mean, changing the name of the law school is one thing, but I think, again, we need to see a little bit more action in the way that things are done. Mm-hmm.
I agree with that, for sure.
So some of the stuff that Queen's has done, so obviously not removing the name of John A., but they removed the big poster of him, and they installed the art of the wampum belts in the lobby. Mm-hmm. What do you both think of these sort of symbolic acts of reconciliation? Do you think that they have an impact, or obviously there's more to be done, but what do you think that their impact is for you personally?
I appreciate them. I really do. Like, when they were installing them in September, I was, like, very happy about them, and, like, just excited that they were actually taking steps like that to kind of make it clear to, like, even other students that, you know, like, we're trying to do our best to reconcile, like, the, you know, the damaged relationships between, like, even just the government and Indigenous people in general in this country. So, but I think, like, an interesting thing, if the school has said that, you know, it's difficult for them to change the name, then maybe we could add, like, that, like, I think our professor Metcalf, she had a great idea of, you know, like, doing, like, the plaque as to what John A. did that was, like, so wrong, obviously, and why we need to remember, like, the actual legacy that he left behind, instead of, you know, things that, like, people try to, like, non-Indigenous students might be, or non-Indigenous people in the community might think are good, like the railroad and whatever else. But yeah, I think, like, a plaque devoted to something like that and just commemorating, like, what truly happened, especially with the residential schools that he was responsible for. So that's pretty much how I feel.
So yeah. Not to, like, idolize him.
Exactly.
So
you know, I think those, you know, small changes or gestures, again, are a start. I don't think that it speaks to the systemic issues of the school or of institutions in general. So as I said earlier, you know, I think that a lot more needs to be done around the learning and development of law students while they're here. So it's one thing to, you know, see wampum belts, which is a beautiful installation, but it's understanding the stories behind that and the narrative behind that. And I don't feel that we necessarily get that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in terms of, you know, the name and creating at least some sort of balance between, you know, the history of what's been done. You know, for me, reconciliation is about acknowledging those things, but it's also too about bringing people into a circle, mm-hmm. or into a space and getting to a point of mutual understanding. And so, you know, I was even thinking, like, why don't we just rename him? Why don't we give him an Anishinaabe name, mm-hmm.
That'd be awesome.
And, you know, and just, like, maybe we can call him what he is. I mean, you know, not to say it needs to be, you know, bad or derogatory or anything like that. But, you know, but maybe we could find a way to bridge these two worlds.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what they are. They're different ways of being, of knowing and doing, mm-hmm. and there's no reason why things can't be balanced. Mm-hmm. But again, like I said, I think there needs to be a bigger attempt or a greater attempt at looking at the systemic issues.
For sure. I agree with that for sure.
In your opinion, so that's all sort of stuff that Queens can do, but as a non-Indigenous student, how can other students also work towards reconciliation within the law school?
Well, for me, like, I think that it's very important that non-Indigenous students take seriously Indigenous issues, right? Because I think a lot of times, well, I'm not completely sure because I don't know what it's like to be a non-Indigenous student, but I think that maybe there's, like, situations where people are talking in groups where there's not Indigenous people and they could be, like, brushing these issues under the rug. Oh, like, yeah, of course. But it's like, no, those issues are important and it's important to, like, understand, you know, what happened and, like, everything, why there's so much distrust between groups and the government especially, and why it's important to maybe, like, take steps of, like, gaining trust as a non-Indigenous student or non-Indigenous lawyer, to be honest, like, that, to make kind of reparations a focus in work, or even just maybe not the focus of their work if they're not interested in that kind of law, but just, like, something that they can include in their work somehow and just take care when they're dealing with Indigenous clients or Indigenous issues in general, and, like, try to make efforts that are going to be helpful and, like, you know, working toward obviously reconciliation as a goal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would suggest that, you know, and it doesn't matter if people are interested in these issues or not, but what I find is it's important that people have questions, mm-hmm. to ask them and to ask the appropriate people.
Yes.
You know, I find that for the most part, Indigenous people are very open to sharing this history, to sharing experiences, more than happy, you know, people that I've met, you know, yeah. are more than happy to share a conversation,
sure.
space, you know, because we want people to learn. We yeah, want people to
absolutely.
Understand. So, I mean, you know, I would just like to see people ask questions. Mm-hmm. Don't make assumptions. Don't rely on the things that, you know, that you might have been told from, you know, a non-legitimate source, mm-hmm. and resting, you know, resting whatever decisions you're making on that, you know. So, you know, seek out the information.
Yes.
If someone sees an injustice taking place,
mm-hmm.
do something about it and speak up. Don't be this officious bystander, right? Don't
yes.
just... Yeah, if you see something that does not sit well with you, then find a way to address it. Just because you know, you may be a non-Indigenous person and you're not sure, you know, maybe how to do that. There's nothing wrong with being genuine and saying, you know what, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to make X change. Who can I, ally with in order to make this happen?
Yes.
So just don't, you know, just don't take things the way they are or gloss over it and think that other people will solve the issue. Sure, some might, but, you know, like it really does take a number of people, you know.
Trying.
Yeah, working together and identifying solutions to be able to see that change.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Well, that reminds me, I remember you mentioning in class the other day that for non-Indigenous students to speak up when they see something
yeah.
or, like, a misconception about other Indigenous people can be important, because you said that sometimes when you do it, people just think it's, like, your own
yes,
bias.
Absolutely, for sure. That's kind of what I was trying to get to in my answer, just sort of, like, because I'm not sure exactly what goes on, like, in a group, if they're talking about Indigenous groups or Indigenous issues, rather, and there's no actual Indigenous authority to comment, you know, like, I'm not really sure, because I usually try to direct people in a better way if they're, like, not, you know, being accurate about something. But I think it is, like, as Stacia was saying before, it's almost, like, a responsibility that non-Indigenous students have, like, almost like a duty to, like, make sure that we're, like, we're talking about these things in a way that's actually helpful and that's actually going to work toward repairing broken relationships between these exact groups. So I think it's important that non-Indigenous students and honestly just non-Indigenous lawyers when we get out there to just make it like a duty to, like, you know, correct people if they're not saying things that are proper or just, or if they're dismissing things as being like, oh, we don't really know how to deal with that. Like, that's not the point. The point is just to try to, like, make some kind of amends or, like, just do something that's actually going to be beneficial to the problem that are there, basically.
Yeah.
So there seems to be, you know, some sort of, I would say, misunderstanding about people who are at law school. You know, they think that, you know, if they go into corporate law, that they're not going to encounter Indigenous people because
right.
it may not be Indigenous law. Or if they go into whatever, securities, that they're somehow not going to interact in, you know, in these areas, or property or anything else. But the intersection of Indigenous issues and all areas of law exist.
Absolutely.
And when people are out in the real world practicing, they're going to see that. And they're not going to know necessarily, you know, what to do or how to respond. And, you know, we need to ensure that while law students are in school getting this education, that they receive the appropriate instruction and guidance and whatever it is, practical experience, in order to be able to apply that.
For sure.
And that's not happening.
Right. I agree with that completely. And even, like, I've noticed that just from my 1L experience that we've dealt with Indigenous issues in three areas of law. So property, crim, and constitutional law. But I find that there's a lack, definitely, not obviously in tort law, but there hasn't been, like, the presence of it in tort or contracts. Contracts a little bit. We have, lovely Professor Carton, who sometimes tries to bring things up, but it might be more difficult in those kinds of areas. But when you think about it, the exchange between government and Indigenous people before sovereignty was established was technically a contract, right? So there could be something to be said there about, like, these kinds of areas of law. But definitely there's intersections that are completely obvious in crim and constitutional and property, I would say. But again, that could just be from my own experience and the benefit that I've had of having profs that are more conscious about these issues. And I'm not sure if that speaks to the rest of the faculty, but I've been pretty, blessed, I guess, in that sense of having those three, at least three profs go over these issues in class and do it in a way that's, like, I mean, it can always be better, but I find it really appropriate and helpful the ways that they've done it in my classes so far. So that's been great.
Yeah. In terms of the actual materials that we learn in class, have you felt that any of them have particularly impacted you in a different way than they would maybe for a non-Indigenous student?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I have a interesting story. we were talking about crim, and it was actually in first year in crim, and we were reviewing a case, and details were somewhat limited, but the case was referred to as the Sweat Lodge case.
What?
And so I was just, you know, I was completely mystified. I'm like, what kind of criminal law case is this?
Yeah.
The Sweat Lodge case. And so the facts were essentially that there was a group of people who were conducting this sweat. And I believe a person had died during the so-called ceremony. And so I was like, oh, this is interesting. You know, it was just an optional reading. And so after class, I was like, I need to look this up. And so I looked up the case. And like I said, in class, the case was presented as a sweat lodge case, that it was an Indigenous ceremony and that someone had died and is, you know, their criminal negligence, essentially. So when I looked up the case, it was actually non-Indigenous people conducting a sweat with non-Indigenous people. and so someone had died. But it was the way that it was presented. Mm-hmm. So in terms of impact, it was being presented as though that this was an Indigenous-led, you know, ceremony and that someone had died.
Wow.
So some of the questions that were being raised by, you know, by the class were, well, you know, well, don't they have that experience? Shouldn't they know how to do that? Is that something that, you know, is traditional? And And I went to the professor after that. And I said, look, I said, you really need to address this.
Yeah.
You know, I said, you have left the class believing that this is, that this was an indigenous, you know, group of people, that it was a traditional ceremony, which it was not, you know.
No.
And that, you know, because of negligence, that someone died because of that behavior. I said, this needs to be corrected. Instead of the professor taking that information and correcting the class, or at least, you know, providing, you know, like, the real facts, actually pointed to me in class, I think it was later on that week, a day or so later. I said, well, Stacia, why don't you speak to this?
What? See, that's what I mean about the authorities on things. I can't speak on something
right
like that.
Like, more than happy to,
yeah.
Right?
But yeah.
More than happy.
But at least, yeah, as long as it's getting addressed.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. You know, I can share what I can in terms of what I've read. And, you know, if you can confirm those facts, great. I said, but I can only speak to my personal views and my opinions on these things. Right. And the same thing, too, with the Gerald Stanley case. And this is a huge issue for me, because the case is referred to as the Colton Bushi case. Colton Bushi was not on trial. Colton Bushi was a victim.
Yeah.
So why are we referring to this criminal case as a Colton Bushi case?
Right, when that was the indigenous
victim. It was Gerald Stanley,
yeah,
who should be held accountable for that. So why are we not positioning this dialogue? Yeah. Like, and this is just so, you know, innocent, mm-hmm. right? People are not even picking up on it.
Right.
But it's like, you know what? This person committed a crime. Mm-hmm. Sure, you know, he had, you know, he went through that process, went through trial, and we know the results of that. But it was his case. Mm-hmm. It was his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Colton Bushi's behavior.
Right.
So
I think that speaks to the, like, just the dialogue between the government and Indigenous people in general, and the systemic racism that, like, exists in that system, because it's, like, so often racialized groups are criminalized, and in our scenario, we, like, you know, Indigenous people are super criminalized by the government, and, like, it's been that way throughout history. And so I think that exact example says, like, oh, the government's just so used to, like, you know, putting the Indigenous person in the place of being a criminal, right? And it's, like, that is just an example, I guess, like, because they focused on the victim as the, like as the name of the case itself, right?
The Indian as the problem.
Yes, exactly.
You know, getting rid of the Indian problem.
Right.
So we come back to these things from 200 years or 250 years ago, right? Where the Indian is the problem, is at the center.
Right.
And, you know, I just, it's not cool.
No, it's really not cool at all. Agree.
I know that, so Rachel, you mentioned
the Katana
previous
case,
that the Katana case was triggering.
Right, it was triggering. Like, so this is interesting, because as I was saying before, I mean, I'm not a Katana, like, from that group, obviously. Like, I can only speak to my experience as being a Ganyan Geha person from Tainanaga. Like, I don't really know how to, especially in the West Coast, there's different things going on there with, like, land and stuff. Like, I mean, similar whole concept, but, like, there's different sort of, like,
it's a little different
nuances.
There's less treaties and
stuff. Yeah, exactly. And the history there is different, right? So, but anyway, we're going over that case in class, and it was just so disheartening, because before we went to that case in class, we were doing a series of freedom of religion cases, and this was the first Indigenous claim, freedom of religion case in Canada, right? So, it seemed like there was a pattern of, oh, the Supreme Court, you know, is being amazing and giving all these, you know, groups these religious rights, and I'm like, that's so good, and I was, like, very feeling happy for all these groups that were getting these, you know, like, rights. And then we get to this Katana case, and it's like the court seemed to just go around the fact. Like, they just made so many different excuses up, it felt like, and as to why they weren't going to grant this group these religious rights. And it's like, why? Like, I just felt very, like, not, I don't want to use the word betrayed, because I can't say betrayed, I'm not from that group, but I just felt like the Supreme Court is just not, I don't know, I think McLaughlin wrote that decision, I can't remember exactly, but.
So the Tunaha Nation, NBC, was a case where there was a proposal to buy a ski resort in a certain area, which was of spiritual significance to the Tunaha Nation. It was the location of the grizzly bear spirit, and the Tunaha held that the developments would drive away the spirit and irrevocably impair their religious beliefs. So they filed a claim under the Freedom of Religion and Section 35 Aboriginal Rights, which both ultimately failed at the Supreme Court.
it just really seems like, okay, well, we're really, the court's willing to do all these backflips and acrobat, like legal acrobatics to make room for these certain groups' rights to exist when it came to freedom of religion specifically. And then when we got to the Katana case, it was like, actually, no, because you want to do a location-based claim of religion. You want to do like all this. And it's like, but this is a legitimate claim. There's literally evidence of before the court to explain that this claim is like real and like actually happening and actually a thing. And it's like, but the court just like just wrote their decision in a way that was so just betraying and like, I don't know, just did not do the group, did not help them at all. Like it just was like, oh, sorry, actually, no, like, I don't know. I can't remember exactly all the details of that case, but I just remember feeling very like sad and like just not happy with that decision. So that was, and even during that class, like when she was going over it, like it just is kind of triggering, I guess. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I can use the word triggering in that case because I'm not, again, from that group, but like it just felt very like disheartening that they were really just not going to give this group the same rights that they've been giving to all these other groups in that whole series of litigation leading up to it. And then it's just like, but why? Like, why can't they? Anyway, that was just an example, I guess.
Yeah, I think the one silver lining with that case in our particular class was a lot of people were upset about, not upset about it, but were sort of pointing out the flaws in the reasoning.
Right. There were so many flaws
in the ways that it didn't really make sense for freedom of religion.
Yeah.
Not that that's really...
I'm glad that people are at least, like, flagging the issues, but it's just still super frustrating that the government, or sorry, I keep saying the government, but I mean the Supreme Court, but just... Anyway, like a tool of the government, I guess, but that they were just so unwilling to just make the repairs that they could have. Like they could have really done a big move that would have been helpful for this kind of litigation, but they just didn't want to go that far. And it's just like really disheartening because they were doing so much for so many other groups.
Yeah, and I have to remember that case. So yeah. I was thinking back to it, and I was like, which one is this?
Katana,
Tunaha.
Oh, Tunaha. See, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm so sorry, yeah.
I actually went to go look up the pronunciation when I was reading that class in first year, and I was like, how do you pronounce this? And then I went, just said, like, I want to pronounce this properly.
Yeah, no, I seriously.
Like, Tunaha.
So yeah, that's right.
Yeah, although right. I'm sorry if I didn't get that right to all the people from that
community.
Me too.
I'm very sorry.
I'm trying. And I remember feeling the same way, feeling really kind of, disheartened.
Yeah,
disheartened,
right? Disappointed, like, just mad. I was mad too.
Yeah.
I think I cried during that class. Like, I don't know why. I just must have been emotional that day, but it was just like, what? Like, why?
I know. And I think some of the problems that, you know, that exist is that we have these, you know, we have these boxes. We have these tests.
The legal tests, yeah.
That exist. And some of these existing tests, especially, you know, when it comes to Section 35(1) rights, they don't... They're very narrow in
scope.
They're
strict, yeah.
Very strict. I mean, you know, we really need to look at ways, you know, to modernize the way that these tests are applied. I mean, the whole notion of pre-contact, you know, culture and traditions. Okay, that's fine. I get that to the point, you know, to a point. But what we failed to understand and part of that analysis is that over a period of time, or actually for up until 1960, Indigenous people were not citizens. So what were we doing in between that time, between pre-contact and 1960? Well, I would argue that we were adapting and modifying our behaviors to survive. Yeah. Absolutely. So things change, and things have to change in order to adapt to those environments in order to ensure that there is that survival. Mm-hmm. So I would say that there are new practices and new things, ways of you know, of culture and tradition and language that are now part of communities that might not have been pre-contact, but have been in response to
colonization
legislation that's rolled out over the years, and that still exists today.
Absolutely. For sure. I think another important thing to mention as well is just the very fact that Indigenous ways of law and just existing and our, you know, stories in the way, like our spirituality even, is so different from the westernized, whatever, Eurocentric, like, law. And, like, so the fact that these tests are so strict and like, the way that they're formed are meant to accommodate, you know, people that were brought up in, like, in that kind of law and so used to, like, the way that area of law works, it's just, it doesn't leave any room for the way that, like, it's organized in Indigenous cultures and Indigenous groups, like, across Canada. It's just, there's no room, like they're so incompatible, those systems. It's like this system isn't willing to, like the colonial settler system basically isn't willing to go far enough to actually really understand what's going on in the indigenous groups. Like they try, I can see like some especially in the dissents of some of those cases, like Laura Dubé and McLaughlin sometimes will say nice things and I'm like, okay, well at least they get it kind of, but it's like, they're still not going far enough and they're still always never in the majority of those decisions. And they're not like getting to the point of like, we have to just understand that the system of law was here literally first. And this, indigenous laws were here first, and like the colonial sort of way of thinking is just not compatible, and it's not going to be able to make the reparations that are actually just super needed. So it's really unfortunate that way.
Do you think that there's anything unique to the field of law specifically that sort of would impact you, or that people need to do towards reconciliation?
I mean, that was pretty much goes to what I was saying about like the duty as lawyers and non-Indigenous lawyers to kind of make those steps and take those steps that are going to be helpful and work move toward reconciliation.
No, I think reconciliation is at any point, but I think particularly lawyers have a duty to ensure that they are knowledgeable, that they are up to date, that they're current, that they're able to best represent their clients,
yes,
that they are, you know, that they're in a position, you know, to provide, you know, solid legal advice.
Yes,
and representation. And yeah, and it doesn't mean that you have an Indigenous client. You may be representing someone, maybe perhaps a mining company who is trying to, have a claim, or maybe a claim against an Indigenous group.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you need to know those things. So I would suggest that, you know, while in law school, if things aren't being offered, you know, for you, look at other opportunities. There's tons of conferences, gatherings, training that takes place. And when you're out, make sure that you use your professional development hours. What do they call them?
CPDs. Yeah.
You use those appropriately and
yeah.
do the things that, you know,
sure.
that are going to obviously benefit you and the area of law that you're in, but also too making that link to the broader issues in the country. And I mean, I think we can all say with certainty that, you know, Indigenous peoples in Canada, as well as the African Canadian or Black community in Canada, are overrepresented in the criminal justice system, have the lowest social determinants of health, and we need to be aware of those things. And I think it's everyone's responsibility. And I think it goes back to the fact that Indigenous people didn't enter into treaties on their own.
No.
We might have had treaties with each other. You know, there are other partners in this relationship, and there is a responsibility for everyone to pick up those pieces and do the work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's also, you mentioned teachers. Like, I think teachers do play another big role in making amends toward reconciliation. It's like, that's a huge, they play a huge role, right? Because they're getting kids when they're young and stuff, and they're making those impressions. That's definitely huge. And doctors too. Like, if you're not, I actually just read something the other day that was, it was basically saying that she was a nurse and she was super aware of the fact that her Black patient was not receiving nearly the same care as like her white patients or whoever. And I just think like that just speaks to racism in general, like these little small microaggressions that like, well, not even microaggressions, those, but then also just like, you know, manifestations of actual racism, like working in these like realms of work and stuff like that, like doctors, teachers, law, all these places, right? Like, so I think it's just important to like make sure that you're not part of the problem, that you're part of the solution in making things better for everyone.
So to wrap up, this is kind of a big question, so no pressure. but what, in your opinion, would reconciliation look like in like 20, 50 years? Like, where would you like to see it in your personal opinion? So all
oh,
personal.
No, I don't want to receive any flack for my personal opinion. Say, should you go first?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I'd really like to see the any decision making on any Indigenous issues come back to the Indigenous community.
Yes.
Whether you're on reserve, whether you're off reserve, you know, we really need to change the way that we talk, you know, to each other, how we talk to each other, the way we talk about each other. And we need to put that authority back where it belongs.
Absolutely.
That's what I want to see. And I think that that could be achievable in the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we can't believe in these statements that we're a nation to nation, you know, that we're in this nation to nation relationship together when you don't actually see that happening.
Yeah.
So the only way that I can actually see, you know, a move towards reconciliation is by actually treating Indigenous nations as nations.
Yes. You know, so thank you. Yes.
You can say it, but you know, you got to find a way to, you know, to make this happen. And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's this, I guess, misconception. And again, some of it too, you know, on stereotypes and other things that, you know, that Indigenous communities don't have the ability or the capability to do these things. I think the fact that we've
survived this long
is a testament to the to the resilience that Indigenous communities have, but yes. also too that, you know, these governance systems, and some are imposed, and you know, communities and leadership are aware of that, but others aren't. You know, there's still traditional and customary governance models that exist, and regardless of whatever, you know, side you're on, there's still legitimacy there.
Absolutely.
So let's put it back in the hands of the people.
Absolutely. I was going to say something exactly like that. Like, obviously, my ideal solution would be, can we please just, you know, make it so that Indigenous groups are, like, able to not be, like, associated with Canada at all. I know that's, like, a little bit crazy, but, like, I just, like, yeah, okay, maybe we find ourselves in the same continent, but it's, like, these are nations and these are countries in themselves. Like, you can go to the res that's down the road, like, where I'm from, like, and it's literally, like, there's so much capability of, like, even just doing your own set of government. Like, even Akwesasne, they have their own court system, and it's not really necessarily associated with Canada at all. Or, well, because Akwesasne is actually a reserve that's, you know, finds itself in Ontario, Quebec, and the United States, like, New York, Northern New York. Anyway, like, I just think that my idea, like, the solution for me, or dream, or whatever, it's not necessarily going to be possible. Maybe I wish, this is my hope, is if we could just get to a place where, you know, Indigenous groups just don't even have to deal with Canada or, like, deal with another country. It's like, that would be the most respectful situation. Like, it's, I don't know, really true reconciliation would be, like, letting these groups operate on their own without, like, any government involvement. It's not needed. It's never been wanted. Like, it's just, that would be the dream. And especially too, working towards rebuilding language and culture, in those communities as well, because that's been a huge problem. Obviously, the residential schools are what kind of, you know, killed off a lot of languages and a lot of, like, association with culture and stuff. And yeah, I even feel it as well, just being mixed and stuff, and that I'm not able to even access, like, I can access language and stuff now, but I wasn't raised in it. And it's unfortunate, because I really wish that, like, I had more access to these things and more protections of language and culture, just, like, in the non-Indigenous world, and more respect for them too. So, yeah.
I was going to say, the only other point I'd like to make, I guess, in terms of, you know, reconciliation, is that when there are conflicts, and when there are, you know, when litigation needs to happen, or when these cases are brought forward on Indigenous issues, they should not be heard in Canada.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
There's a conflict of interest that we don't talk about, right?
Like, absolutely.
We can't have the Crown protecting, you know, the Indigenous
when they have their own interests that are completely opposed.
Yeah, and the interests are completely opposed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have systems that exist. We have international systems. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be using, you know, the International Court of Justice, why we shouldn't be using those models and taking these concerns and these issues, you know, to different spaces to have them heard.
Yeah.
You know, and whether it doesn't mean we actually have to physically, you know, go somewhere else. Perhaps we could have, because of, you know, the size of our population here in Canada, and even perhaps the United States. So you could have satellite. We do satellite courts all the time. Why not have a sitting satellite ICJ in Canada? You know what? I could see that happening in probably more 50 years, but I'd like to hope it's before I go back to the spirit world. But you know, but you know, I think we need to start thinking creatively about these things, right?
Okay.
And finding methods, you know, that are going to work for Indigenous people, and then Indigenous people have choice.
Yes.
And so if we can create more options and more choice
yeah.
where people can go, then I think that we're on the right path.
I love that. Yeah, I love that plan.
Well, thank you both for coming today and for all your wonderful thoughts.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks, Michelle.
That's it for today's episode. Pro Bono Radio is brought to you by Queen's Faculty of Law, Pro Bono Students Canada, and with the generous support of CFRC, Queen's Campus Community Radio Station, broadcasting at 101.9 FM and online at cfrc.ca. The show was written and produced by the students of Queen's Law and is intended for entertainment purposes only. We are not lawyers. Nothing contained in the episode should be considered as legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Pro Bono Radio is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory.